On an evening in early December 2018, the young CEO of a cryptocurrency exchange reportedly dies while on his honeymoon in India. This death is not announced to customers for another month. And when they're told Gerald Cotton is the only person to hold the passwords to their funds, conspiracy theories grow, leaving some to wonder, could Gerald Cotton still be alive?
Honeymoon, moving the body, all the missing money. It was like, but what happened?
A Death in Cryptoland. Available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Last Tuesday, a gunman opened fire at multiple spas in Atlanta, Georgia, killing 8 people, including 6 Asian American women. It marked a culmination of a year of racism against Asians and Asian Americans in the U.S., some of which was attributed to President Donald Trump's consistent rhetoric blaming the COVID-19 pandemic on China. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris met with Asian American leaders in Atlanta on Friday, condemning this rising tide of discrimination and violence. On today's episode, we get into this year of violence and what the political response has been so far. For more, I'm speaking with Kim Tran, an anti-racist researcher and consultant based in Oakland, and Arissa Oh, a professor of history at Boston College. You're listening to Party in the USA. Let's get into it. Arissa, Kim, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, thanks.
So we'll start with the horrific Atlanta shooting. It has been really just the latest incident in what has been an awful year of violence against Asian Americans.
Who've been attacked, harassed, blamed, and scapegoated, forced to live in fear for their lives, just walking down streets in America. It's wrong, it's un-American, and it must stop.
A coalition tracking reports of racism against Asian Americans said it received almost 4,000 firsthand complaints over the last year and over 500 complaints so far in just the first 2 months of this year alone. These include incidents ranging from verbal harassment to physical assaults. Let's start with a really basic question, which is, how are you doing? Kim, let's start with you.
In two words, not well. Mm. This has been a really challenging year that has changed pretty basic behaviors from a lot of people in my life. So I no longer am allowed to walk the dog by myself per my partner's wishes. Mm. And my mom and my family, after having a family friend who was victimized, have changed their habits considerably. So it's been really challenging. I think a large part of what I felt after Atlanta was this is the kind of logical extension of what this year has produced.
Mm. What about yours?
I have been in the kind of fortunate but unfortunate position of having a very, very small world for the last year, going to campus, teaching my classes and coming home. And so I personally have not had to change my habits, but I am really on edge when I'm outside. If somebody looks at me the wrong way, I get a little bit concerned. Obviously, I'm mostly concerned about sort of the mental health of my students, mm-hmm. who are not only trying to learn through a pandemic, but also, you know, the Asian American students, the students who are interested in anti-racist organizing, social justice. I think that they have a lot of heavy mental burden and emotional burden on top of all of the stresses of the year.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're a politics podcast, and we're going to set this conversation in the world of politics. And one of the things that has been attributed to this rise in anti-Asian violence has been, you know, this connective thread to President Donald Trump last year talking about how COVID-19 was China's fault.
But you don't hear them talking about COVID. To be specific, COVID-19. That name gets further and further away from China, as opposed to calling it the Chinese virus.
Kim, is that a fair relationship to draw?
I will say, while that is an assessment that a lot of folks are making, when we look at what Asian Americans are doing in social justice protest movements, when we look at what scholars have traced for the last number of decades, if not longer than that, we see a much longer trajectory for anti-Asian sentiment, xenophobia, and anti-Asian violence. Mm-hmm. This is a concentrated moment. It is not, for me, a moment that is unique. There's a reason we can go easily toward the narrative of Asian disease.
Mm-hmm.
it's accessible, it's there, it exists, and it has existed for a very long time. So while for a lot of folks, this is the first time that they maybe saw it, it's really, for me as a scholar and as someone who does this work, inaccurate to think this is new in any way, shape, or form.
Right. I mean, Arissa, there is this sort of misunderstanding of anti-Asian racism, anti-Asian hatred as like this relatively new phenomenon that we don't even have language for, which is, of course, just far from the truth. We should note that there's been a demonstrable increase in violence against Asians and Asian Canadians here in Canada as well. The Vancouver Police Department reported that anti-Asian hate crimes increased by 717% from 2019 to 2020. This violence is not new. It's part of a long history of violence and racism against Asians on this continent. Can you take us a little bit through the history that got us to this wave of violence, Arissa?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting, too, that to be talking to, you know, the CBC or, you know, a Canadian politics podcast about what's happening in the U.S., because mm-hmm. I think it is important to remember that Canada and the United States did enact anti-Asian policies in concert with each other, right? I mean, these are connected
yes.
policies and conversations and stereotypes and anti-Asian movements that went on both sides of the border, that straddled the border. By now, probably everybody has heard that the federal immigration system in the United States begins with a law that bars Asian Mongolian, as they're called, women, and Chinese and Mongolian women from coming to the United States on the presumption that they're immoral and that they're prostitutes, right? And so right there, we see the intersection of the sort of understanding of Asian women in particular, right, being understood as immoral, as degenerate, as a threat to not only the public health, but sort of the moral health of the nation. And, you know, of course, after that, you have the Chinese Exclusion Act, you have the incarceration of Japanese Americans. Before that, you have violence against Filipinos on the West Coast, ongoing violence against the Chinese in the 19th century, you know, infamously the driving outs from several locations. So in particular, as Kim was saying, people talk about how this upsurge in anti-Asian violence is new and different and unique, and we have no way of talking about it. But it actually has been continuous throughout U.S. history. It's just a matter of the degree to which it has kind of broken through into mainstream consciousness and different moments at which it kind of becomes something that the mainstream wants to talk about because it becomes a useful focus for talking about multiple anxieties and crises.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about those anxieties because author Kathy Park Hong wrote the book Minor Feelings. She recently spoke to The Atlantic about how this wave of anti-Asian violence feels different from previous years. That is interesting to me as a political entry point. You know, she said a lot has changed because of Donald Trump, that people have been more upfront in talking about race and structural racial inequities in this country. She also spoke about Black Lives Matter and being a galvanizing factor in encouraging other communities to organize. Do you guys agree with this idea that this moment feels different? Kim, let me start with you.
You know, I really appreciate Kathy Park Hong's work. I will say that there's a contribution that I would make within that argument, which is that for specifically marginalized genders within Asian America, this doesn't feel very different. When we look at what happened in Atlanta, we're talking about folks who are systemically vulnerable as sex workers, as women, as people who are from a country where imperialism has a very recent past. For me, as a Vietnamese woman, I'm always kind of a little bit flummoxed by the idea that state-sponsored violence and tropes of Asian women hypersexualized and in sex work isn't a really present memory for people. So for me, it's a both and. And as someone whose research is on what solidarity has looked like in the Black Lives Matter era, there have always been really vibrant social protest within Asian America. We are specifically the most coalitionary formation of radical politics. That being said, BLM has definitively shifted how we understand solidarity, but has it really changed whether or not communities of color show up? Maybe, maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Arissa, I'm curious about your take, because we do have like a, I guess, a broader public language now because of things like Black Lives Matter and the strides that the organizing has made. Does this moment feel different for you?
I think that there is a possibility for this moment to be different. I think I'm somewhat with Kim in my perhaps lack of, let's say, tempered hopefulness maybe about this. I do notice, and I know that historically we always say, oh, the younger generations will save us. But my students talk about intersectionality. Mm. You know, I don't have to tell them what that is. Mm. They come to class knowing what that is. And they know, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw's, you know, theorizing is out in the mainstream. And I think that there is a possibility for cross-racial coalitions and, you know, for the kind of work that Kim is talking about. By the same token, we see people, perhaps the people with more power, responding to these kinds of attacks and this problem of anti-Asian violence in the same old ways, right? Where they call for more policing or, right. Oh, you know, let's all love each other and let's all talk to each other more, you know? And so there are ways in which that kind of dominant way of dealing with the anti-Asian violence comes to the forefront immediately and maybe will kind of foreclose the possibility to do something different this time.
We're just going to take a quick break right there. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this idea of Asian American as a broad political category.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week, you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listened to it.
Howard,
that's
you...
the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back, and I want to talk about conversations about race in America because they often are reduced to this binary, this sort of black and white binary. Kim, Asian American is an extremely broad category, and when we talk about anti-Asian racism, even that still feels like a very vague conversation that isn't very specific at all. How useful is that Asian American category in terms of addressing this problem?
So I'm always really interested in when folks say Asian America, knowing the history of where that comes from. It's a political formation. It's not a census category, right? So when we say Asian American, what we actually mean is a broad coalition of people who vaguely trace their roots back to the Asian continent on America in the interest of racial justice movements. That's what we're talking about. And that's kind of what we've called ourselves since the late 60s. And Asian American organizers took up that mantle. And you still see really strong remnants of that legacy. I'm in the Bay Area, and a lot of my research and a lot of my movement work is with people here in my hometown. So folks here are organized under things like the Third World Resistance Front. They're organizing under Asians for Black Lives. We're toting signs that say Palestine for Black Lives Matter. So
yes.
When we think about Asian America, that's who I think about. And this has been one of the most clear moments to me that when other folks say Asian American, they don't mean the same thing as me necessarily.
Yes.
They're not talking about a loose conglomeration of people who are interested in anti-imperialism and correcting gender-based harm within movements. They're talking about something else. So I am really connected to the greater project of Asian America that we find from the late 60s. The same reason we use Black American or Black Power, we're using Asian American, but somewhere along the way, we've lost that sense of history.
You know, I want to keep digging into this idea. I think that's really interesting. This idea of Asian American as a maybe as a political category. So on Wednesday, the House Committee on the Judiciary heard from both Republican and Democrat Asian American representatives and from other witnesses about this rise of discrimination and violence against Asian Americans. What was interesting about that hearing is that it was scheduled before the Atlanta attack, well before the Atlanta attack. And Democrat Congresswoman Grace Meng, who reintroduced an anti-Asian American hate crime bill in February, had some pointed words for Trump and the Republican Party.
Your president and your party and your colleagues can talk about issues with any other country that you want, but you don't have to do it by putting a bullseye on the back of Asian Americans across this country, on our grandparents, on our kids. This hearing was to address the hurt and pain of our community and to find solutions, and we will not let you take our voice away from us.
And also we heard from actor and advocate Daniel Dae Kim, who was a witness.
Because you may consider us statistically insignificant now, but one more fact that has no alternative is that we are the fastest growing racial demographic in the country. We are 23 million strong. We are united. And we are waking up.
Arissa, I'm curious about the translation of that idea of Asian American as a political category. Is this a new moment for its political power as a category?
You know, I have to agree with Kim in terms of the way that Asian American gets used today. It really has been diluted in a way so that it's lost the kind of revolutionary, as she says, anti-imperialist roots. And so, you know, what does Asian American actually mean when Daniel Dae Kim says it versus somebody who is actually organizing within communities? And I'm not trying to insult Daniel Dae Kim, right? I'm not saying... Yes.
We're all being very careful these days about not insulting Daniel Dae Kim.
Yes, Daniel Dae Kim. Yes, I don't mean to diss you. I'm sorry. I'm just saying, like, I think that this term Asian American is just so big.
Yes.
And it's so floppy. And it no longer, well, as Kim says, it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to everybody. And so I think sometimes that when somebody like Daniel Dae Kim says, oh, you know, we Asian Americans, you know, from the outside looking in versus from the inside looking out, or even from the inside looking in, you know, there's so many gradations of what generation are you? What class are you? Are you here because you came through a refugee program? Are you here because your parents were engineers, right? There are all these kinds of nuances that get lost internally within the community so that, yeah, people use the term Asian American without necessarily specifying what they mean, but also from the outside looking in. And so I think that this kind of uninterrogated use of Asian American, it's not necessarily productive because particularly when you have successful East Asian actor, right, saying it, it doesn't necessarily encompass the kinds of, you know, in the most recent incident, marginalized, sexualized, you know, whatever, like the people who are marginalized even within the marginal category of Asian American.
Kim, I'm curious if we take sort of that, what Arissa called the sort of floppy application, and I think floppy is such like an excellent descriptor of the way that the term gets used. Is there a way of harnessing that power and actually like turning it into a more mainstream political movement? Like, is that possible or is it too depoliticized?
Oh, that's such a good question. And we are being really careful about not dissing Daniel Dae Kim.
Let's
continue to be really careful there.
Of course.
But one of the things that I found the most troubling about these recent forays into activism for a lot of very visible Asian Americans is phrases like, well, we are waking up. Well, some of us have been awake.
Right.
And some of us have been awake because we are systematically disadvantaged in some way, shape, or form. And it's very clear to me that folks either are not in community with Asian sex workers, trans women, queer people, poor people, incarcerated people, or that's just not on their radar. But those folks have been organizing and awake for a long time. So for me, a better catalyst in this moment is we are listening to the people who have been speaking up about systemic vulnerabilities in this moment in Asian America. And that's where I want us to be. And I think that is a really powerful place to organize from, because that's kind of the foundational piece of solidarity. It's listening. It's acknowledging that we have different experiences. And the closer you are to these axes of privilege, whether it's you have financial advantage because you're, you know, a famous person, or you're a cisgender man, or you're straight, or you're light skinned, the closer you are to those axes of privilege, the further removed you are from the folks who might need support the most.
I think what I was struck with there, Arissa, is this idea of, yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying, Kim, is like sort of this proximity to power. Because, you know, one stat that often gets bandied about is that Asian Americans tend to make more money than white Americans do, for example. A stat like that thrown out without any context ends up distorting the picture because it perpetuates this model minority myth that a lot of people have had to live with for such a long time. What is our way out of that, Arissa? Have you done any thinking on evolving and deepening the nuance of these identities?
communities.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that makes the Asian American category so floppy, to use my term once again, is, you know, like you say, you know, like, let's say the average Asian American makes more than the average white American, but the Asian American community also has the widest wealth inequality within it.
Yes.
Right? So you have the highest earners and the lowest earners. And so one of the important things that people need to understand, well, everybody needs to understand, is that Asian American, whether it's useful as a political category or not, it's a ginormous category and it needs to be disaggregated.
Right.
And so there have been sort of these pushes to disaggregate the data, particularly when it comes to college admissions, right, which is where Asian Americans always seem to actually be relevant to the conversation. But, you know, to disaggregate the data and to appreciate the nuances of this large category of Asian American and to pay much more attention to class and the decade when people came versus just sort of lumping them all in as Asian Americans, and to understand the immigration policies that made their entry possible, right? Which is what is responsible for so much of this disparity within the Asian American community. Like, to understand that post-1965 immigrants, for example, were selected by the state specifically to be model minorities.
Right.
To be the doctors and the engineers and the nurses, et cetera, versus other populations who aren't nearly as visible and who aren't understood to be Asian American in quite the same way because they don't fit the class profile, for example, in the popular imagination.
Mm-hmm. So we have this moment where the president and the vice president are speaking out about this. You know, Biden, Kamala Harris, they've spoken out against the increase in violence. They met with leaders of the Asian American community in Atlanta on Friday. Is there some kind of meaningful executive political action in response to the rise in this violence? What do you expect to see? Kim, let me start with you.
Sure. I want to say something to, I think, Arissa's point earlier, which was we need to disaggregate this data, because when you disaggregate Asian America, you get a different series of issues that we're interested in, right? So while I think it's appropriate, it makes sense that the Biden administration visited Atlanta and said a bunch of stuff, a few days ago, they deported an airplane full of 33 Vietnamese men. And it was not really covered on the news at all. The only reason I know is because I have organizing community who was fighting that plane taking off and lost. So the executive action is going to be different depending on who you ask.
Yes.
For me, one of the things I'm interested in right now, if we are really committed to this moment, if we are really interested in Asian American as a political term and as a political movement, we're going to decriminalize sex work right now. A lot of sex workers have talked about what they've endured over the last number of years with their criminalization around SESTA, FOSTA, Backpage going down, a safer source of income revenue for them.
Yes.
So decriminalizing sex work is really up there on my list of priorities. And another one is thinking about how we take resources away from things like ICE and funnel them into mental health, into community-based programming. So those are my two issue areas. If you're asking a queer Vietnamese woman what she thinks.
Right. I appreciate even that disaggregation of political action, because it is such a broad umbrella that, you know, there's always a temptation to cast as broad and vague a net as possible in order to appear like you're doing something to everybody. But in the process, you don't really end up actually creating a policy that is specific at all. Arissa, what are you hoping to see?
I mean, I am not a policy person. I agree with what Kim says in terms of sort of the immigration priorities and the decriminalization of sex work. Well, the decriminalization of sex work doesn't happen at the executive level, but I certainly think that, you know, immigration and deportation policies need to be changed. I would say, from my point of view, it drives me crazy when Joe Biden gets up and says, this anti-Asian violence is un-American. Or anti-Black violence is un-American. I don't think that's helpful at all, just at the most basic level for the public discourse, right? Anti-Asian, anti-Black violence, violence against Native Americans. I mean, these are the foundations of the country, actually. And so I feel like it feeds into this kind of shock that people have, like, oh, how could this kind of thing happen? And it just feeds into this false innocence, I think, that people have about the sources of this kind of violence, the sexualized, gendered, racialized sources of this violence, imperialism, which I didn't even mention, right? But the U.S. military adventures abroad and how that feeds into sort of stereotypes about Asians in the United States, mm-hmm. as well as Asians actually being in the United States. And so I think that this whole narrative about this kind of violence being un-American, it just needs to stop. I think the problem needs to be identified before it can be tackled, because this kind of thing is not exceptional.
Kim, Arissa, I think we've barely scratched the surface of this conversation, but I really appreciate you taking the time to talk through this with me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
And that is it for this week. Our guests were Kim Tran, an anti-racist researcher and consultant, and Arissa Oh, a professor of history at Boston College. I'm your host, Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, and I will talk to you again on Thursday on the regular version of Party Lines with Rosemary Barton. I will see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.